22 is where we're going to be tonight, continuing our study of Young Faces of Faith. And we're going to be, first of all, in the first three chapters of the book of Daniel tonight. We're going to look at, been excited for this study because these are familiar stories that we talk about a lot of great lessons here, perfect example of the kind of thing we're trying to emphasize this quarter. The kind of very committed faith that is demonstrated by some very young people in the Scriptures. So, Daniel chapter 1. So Daniel chapter 1 opens with one of the waves of captives that are taken from Judah to Babylon, and as Judah is coming closer and closer to complete destruction by the Babylonians, and this is Daniel and his three friends that we're going to be reading about in today's lesson. So tell me about the royal program that's described in the first several verses, verses 3 through 5. Who's part of this? What's it all about? Because Daniel and his friends are become part of it. What's going on here? Okay. When we think of the Jews going into captivity, we sometimes just think of them going into abject bondage, and that's really not the case. They're being exiled to a foreign country, but for in a lot of ways, life is just going to go on. But for certain young men in particular, they're being selected out for a program of public service. Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians generally did this. They weren't dumb. If you conquered a people, you took their best and brightest and put them to work to make your own kingdom, your own empire better. That's what Nebuchadnezzar is doing. And so verse 3 says, the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and the nobles, youths in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. He ordered him to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine that he drank, and appointed that they should be educated. How long? All right, there's a 3-year program. 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. So again, we're picking the best and brightest. We're picking people with not only with the right appearance, the right physical condition, but also with the right intellectual kinds of thing. Remember, a lot of people in those days had no education whatsoever, or very, very little. So these are people who have had some education. These are people from probably more well-to-do families, and again, the royal family is mentioned. Daniel and his three friends, and we hardly ever call them by their Hebrew names that are given in verse 6, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Because this is the last time we really encounter those names pretty much. The commander of the officials gave new names to them. For some reason, we keep calling Daniel by his Hebrew name, but we call the other three by their new Chaldean names. Daniel, what's the new name Daniel gets? I'm being mean making you pronounce all these. All right, Belteshazzar, not to be confused with Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, that's later. Belteshazzar and his three friends, Hananiah becomes Shadrach, Mishael becomes Meshach, Azariah, Abednego, probably all names derived from the names of Babylonian deities or something. But as is typical, people are given a new name to reflect their new station and, in a way, a new identity. in this situation. And those are the names that are going to stick, especially for Daniel's three friends. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, those are the names we always call them by. All right. So this sounds pretty good. And sometimes we forget this, a lot better than the situation for many of the people who remained in Judah, who are poor, who are without skilled craftsmen, who are just kind of scratching out a subsistence living. And these men have not only been transplanted to the new place, they're being signed up for government service. They're being educated on the taxpayer's dime or shekel or whatever it was. They are being fed. They're being given the best provisions. This is a great program. But Daniel has a problem. Daniel and his friends who are Hebrews have a problem, but it's Daniel who's kind of the focus. What's the problem? Okay. There is something about the dietary provisions. And so it says, verse 8, Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. And so he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. And there's a couple of possible explanations for exactly what's going on here. The most common one is that this involved foods that were on the prohibited list, Leviticus chapter 11, as listed as unclean, and that was the thing that Daniel and his friends were most concerned about. Maybe also along with that, that these things had been sacrificed to idols. I think the unclean is probably the simplest explanation. Whatever all the specifics are, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are involved in this as well. But they've made up their mind they're not going to go along with this. They see it as a moral issue. So I'm going to be satisfied to conclude it was a moral issue. It was an issue of what the law said they could and couldn't do. Is it a big deal for Daniel to say, hey, we'd like to be made an exception to the dietary provisions in this program? Yeah, okay. Why is it a big deal? Okay, this is the king's provisions that they're being fed out of. This is the best of the best as far as the Babylonians are concerned in terms of the things they can eat and drink. That's liable to be an insult to the king himself. And when Daniel approaches one of the royal official who's in charge of all this, who, by the way, views Daniel very favorably, but he's very hesitant because what's his reasoning? Okay, look, if I let you guys just eat vegetables, and you end up looking more haggard than everybody else, that's my head. I could lose my life. These are the things that are in play. Why are we talking about this? Well, because Daniel is taking a stand on something that really, to us, does this seem like that big a deal? Without knowing the details, it is hard to say. Yeah. That's the thing, yeah. And I'm not saying it's not a big deal. I'm just saying it's very easy for us to look at this and, just eat the food, Daniel. It's very easy to look at that and say, just go on the assumption, this is a really difficult situation, God will overlook it. Daniel is not willing to bet on that without without any kind of revelation from God to that effect, it seems. And Daniel gets revelations from God as we go through his story. He's willing to stand up for this principle at great risk to himself, and really other people, the official in charge, taking a risk too. Daniel says, just give us 10 days. 10 days. And, at the end of 10 days, then, then if we look the worse for wear, then you do what you need to do. Deal with us as you see fit. At the end of the 10 days, what happens? Yeah, Daniel and his friends look better than anybody else does. And so the king's official allows them to continue to eat only vegetables because he has, you know, seen the end result of that. It's very hard not to think that that's God providentially caring for Daniel and his friends because they've taken a stand on principle for what's right. And the overall end result of this, go down to verse 17. As for these four youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. At the end of the days when the king, which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and out of them not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's personal service. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in his realm. All right? So, that's our first lesson from the book of Daniel. And we have seen Daniel and his three friends, Daniel's kind of the spokesman in this, stand up for a principle at personal risk. A principle that a lot of people would look at and say, I don't see what's so important about that, but they did because they understood what God's law said. They were committed to doing God's law in God's way, regardless of the consequences. And we're going to see that play out in an even more dramatic fashion in chapter 3. We'll get to that in just a moment. Questions or comments so far? It's hard to come up with that because we know this story. Right? This is one of the stories that so many of us learn from such a young age. And this is why we learn it from a young age. Because here are these relatively young men who are in an entirely new place. By the way, do any of the Babylonians care about this principle? They don't share that. You know, in fact, in the Babylonian mind, the Chaldean mind, we're offering you the very best there is. You can't do any better than this food and this wine. This is the king's portion. So they would not understand or be very supportive of. It's a blessing from God that Daniel wins the favor of this, you know, this court official that he's dealing with. They're young. They're in a strange place. They're being groomed for very important work. This is part of the qualifications for that work. You know, they don't want to let anybody down, I'm sure. Does it sound familiar? Can you envision a circumstance where we might feel the same, even if we're not talking about, you know, eating meat that's on the unclean list, because we're talking about new covenant service as Christians, but does any of this start to sound like maybe a circumstance that we might face? I'm getting blank looks. Okay, we got to dig in here and make some application. Shane, go ahead. Okay, all right. Anybody else? Yep.
Settings to where if you're going to rise up in an organization or make those relationships outside and within the organization, that you might be thrown into some situations where your convictions toward, you know, the social drinking or other activities would be on the line for you to make a decision. Am I going to participate in that to fit in? To move myself forward or upward in an organization. And it doesn't have to be business related. It can be just, you know, social organizations out in the community, just a number of things that could call on you to not stick to your convictions in order to fit in, to do those things that others would like for you to participate in that you don't want.
Okay, yeah, all right. Let's talk about a couple more things and see what else we can learn, see what other applications we can find. Daniel 2, just note, a little note at the end of Daniel 1, verse 21, Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. Just note, that's a long time. Daniel serves as a royal official, not only under the Babylonians, but even when the Persians take over. He continues on as evidently some kind of governor even then, and this, many, many years of his life. Chapter 2, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, he had dreams. His spirit was troubled, his sleep left him. Of course, here's another chapter we're pretty familiar with. The king gave orders to call in the magicians, the conjurers, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans to tell him his dreams, and so they came in and stood before the king. He said, I had a dream, and my spirit is anxious to understand the dream. And so they said, well, O king, live forever. Tell the dream to your servants, and we will declare the interpretation. And Nebuchadnezzar says, oh, not so fast. You tell me the dream. Which has led one or two commentators to suggest that maybe Nebuchadnezzar didn't remember all the details of the dream, just had a kind of a fuzzy outline of it. Perhaps, I think it's more likely that he's just trying to test what these guys are really made of in terms of, of their supposed, this is a prophetic gift that he's assuming they have, that the gods are granting to them the interpretation of dreams, that they can offer the spiritual meaning, or the, in this case, the political meaning of whatever dreams the king had, it was widely believed in pagan cultures that dreams meant things, and certainly the dreams of the king, who was kind of the embodiment of the favor of the gods, if not the gods themselves, his dreams had to mean something. Okay, tell us the dream. No, that's not how it works. You tell me the dream, and you tell me its interpretation. And if you don't, well, verse 5, pretty dramatic. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you'll be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a rubbish heap. If you do declare it, you will receive from me gifts and a reward and great honor. Therefore, declare to me the dream and its interpretation. The king's wise men, they keep backpedaling. You tell us the dream. We'll tell you the interpretation. No. Not how it works. And they basically just say, verse 10, that's impossible. There is not a man on earth who could declare the matter for the king, inasmuch as no great king or ruler has ever asked anything like this of any magician, conjurer, or what does that, what are they conceding right here in verse 10? I know this is kind of beside the point of our lesson, but I can't pass it over. Yeah. They're admitting that they really have no power. They really have no gift as far as any kind of spiritual insight. Shane, you had your hand up. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say that Nebuchadnezzar seems to be very shrewd. And even if you read into it, when he talks to Daniel, others, superstitions and whatnot are, you know, somewhat charlatans. Mm-hmm. That, you know, anybody can interpret a dream. If you tell them, they can make up something and say what it means. You know, mm-hmm. You tell me what the dream is, and I'll make up some answers of what it
sure.
what it means. I think he understood that mm-hmm. of these people was.
Oh yeah. Nebuchadnezzar is not dumb. By the way, Nebuchadnezzar is, there's a lot of depth to this man's character that is revealed in Scripture. It's not all good, but we get a lot of insight into the kind of person he was. And as Shane pointed out, he was very shrewd and not dumb and not a fool. He pretty, you know, showed wisdom in some regards. He could also be very harsh and demanding. As on this occasion, when the wise men keep insisting, verse 11, look, the only person who could do what you're asking for is one of the gods, and they don't dwell in human form. You know, we're at a loss here. How does Nebuchadnezzar react to this?
He's not very happy.
He's not happy. He's enraged and orders the destruction of all these wise men. Well, who is included in that group? Okay, all right. Even though, so far as we know, they haven't been involved in this conversation, but they're part of the larger group that Nebuchadnezzar just decides, I'm done with all of you. Okay, and people do this, by the way. You know, you have a bad experience with one person out of a group, you just want to get rid of the whole group. That's where Nebuchadnezzar is. And he gives the order. And the decree goes forth, verse 13, that the wise men should be slain, and they look for Daniel and his friends to kill them. So Daniel replied with discretion and discernment to the king's bodyguard. His name was Arioch, who had gone forth to slay the wise men. He asks what's going on. He requests, you know, give me time in order that I might declare the interpretation to the king. What do we see happen in verses 17 and 18?
Okay.
All right. These are not just men of principle, they're men of prayer too. That shouldn't be surprising. But both of those things are revealed to us. Daniel went to his house, informed his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, so they might request compassion from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his friends would not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babel. And we already read back in chapter 1, that Daniel was given the understanding of visions and dreams, verse 17 says. So this is the avenue. They're not going on assumptions. They're praying about this. Their lives are at stake. Now, the next several verses tell us that the mystery was revealed to Daniel. He receives from God the interpretation of the dream. And so he goes to the king's official that's, you know, been given the charge to wipe out all the wise men, verse 24, and, you know, take me into the king's presence and I will declare the interpretation. And you kind of get the impression that this official is really relieved because he rushes Daniel into the king's presence. And at this point, if Daniel gets it wrong, what's going to happen? Okay. If Daniel gets it right and the king just doesn't like it, what could happen? Okay. I mean, this is a little tough for us to relate to, maybe. None of us like going to the DMV, for instance. Okay. And we always feel like, you know, we're at a significant disadvantage, and, you know, we just have to, whatever they say the fee is, that's what we've got to pay. But I don't think you go in there feeling like your life is literally in the hands of the person on the other side of the counter. And that if you mess up, then, you know, somebody's going to behead you. With an ancient despot like Nebuchadnezzar, that was exactly the circumstance. If he was having a bad day and didn't like what you said, it's possible something really bad could result from that. Daniel goes into this with great confidence. Now, Daniel does everything with great confidence when he's because he's trying to do what God wants him to do. And so, verse 25, they bring him in. Hey, one of the exiles from Judah can make the interpretation known to the king. The king said to Daniel, are you able to do this? Verse 27, Daniel said, just summarize it for me. What does Daniel say about what he's about to do? About interpreting this dream and all that. It's really important what Daniel says about it. Yeah, okay. He says, God gives the interpretation of these things. Yeah, go ahead, Jeff. Sure. Yeah, very good. Shay?
Well, again, this is another situation that reminds me of Joseph. Joseph interpreted dreams. But even in Joseph's case, when he interpreted the dreams of the cupbearer and the baker.
And that's a good point. And without spending time talking about it, what is this dream about? This dream is about what God is going to do in the future. This is much greater in scope than the baker and the cupbearer. Am I going to rot in prison, or am I going to be executed, or am I going to get my job back? It's even greater in scope than 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine in Egypt. This is specifically about God working in history among the kingdoms of men. And that's what, that's exactly how Daniel describes it. And that's, to Jeff's point in verses 20 to 23, that's what Daniel is talking about God having revealed, is the things that God is going to do. So when he approaches Nebuchadnezzar, it's God who gives the interpretation, because this is about what God is going to do. It's another great statement in one of the prophetic books about what prophecy is ultimately about. It's about God declaring, hey, here's what I'm going to do. Not just guessing and even guessing from an advantage point as to what's going to happen. It's, this is going to happen because I've decided it's going to happen, God says. And so Daniel gives the dream, he gives the interpretation, and he gives credit to God. And of course the reaction is not one of anger or great dismay or anything like that. Daniel is promoted, verse 46. The king fell on his face, did homage to Daniel, gave orders to present him an offering, fragrant incense. Surely your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, since you have been able to reveal this mystery. And he promoted Daniel rewarded him. Daniel made requests of the king. He appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the administration of the province of Babylon while Daniel was at the king's court. That's important because of what happens next in chapter 3. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not nobodies. They are in very, very important government positions. And so they are going to be expected to set the tone for everybody else. They're expected to be good citizens, patriots, They're expected to show everybody else what a good Babylonian, even though they're transplants, what do good Babylonians do? You're officials over the province now. Okay, so what happens in chapter 3? We all know this story too, I know. What is Nebuchadnezzar set up? He sets up this great golden image. All right? What's the instruction that's given? Yeah, okay. When you hear the music play, everybody bow down to the image. And so they play the music and everybody bows down, but it comes to light, there were three guys that didn't bow down. Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. And you can kind of sense you kind of get the sense in a lot of these stories that some of the other officials are always trying to get these transplanted Jews in trouble. So they're very eager to, hey, you know, he didn't bow down, that kind of thing. So you can sort of get that sense as well. And also the sense of, oh, come on, guys, everybody's doing this. This is the patriotic thing to do. This is your duty as good citizens, and you guys are government officials. That's a bad analogy. I started to say it's like having, you know, Congress people who refuse to say the Pledge of Allegiance, but that's not a very, you know, that doesn't quite work because we've got them. But it's sort of on that level. This is just the patriot. So what if you don't believe in the, you know, and if it's an image of Nebuchadnezzar in his, you know, divine role as king, bow down to him. So what? He's the king. Or if it's one of the Babylonian gods, well, so what? You know, it's who cares if you believe in him or not? Just bow down already. It's the sociable thing to do. It's the patriotic thing to do. So why won't Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego do it? Yeah, really, yeah. That's Jeff's exactly right. A huge part of the reason these boys are in Babylon in the first place is because their countrymen have been doing this kind of thing, bowing down to idols. It's idolatry and they won't do it. It's really simple. Now, I want you to imagine this. You're in this huge crowd of people. And the trumpets play, you know, the music plays. It's all described in detail in the text. And everybody's bowing down, and, you know, say one of the other officials that, you know, you've made some acquaintance with, Shadrach, what's the matter with you? Come on. You think the pressure was real? Yeah. You think they knew a lot was at stake? What had Nebuchadnezzar already decreed would happen to anybody who wouldn't bow down to this image? Okay? Which was evidently one of Nebuchadnezzar's favorite ways of executing people. Throw them in a furnace of fire. When it comes to his attention that these three Hebrews will not bow down to the image, he brings them in front of him. And you notice, he tries to give them a chance to make amends. He says, you know, is this true what I'm hearing about you? It's like, surely there must be some error in communication. I can't believe that you would do this. And if you're ready, then when the music plays, you may, you know, bow down and everything will be fine. And they said, we're not going to do it. And he follows it up, of course, with, well, if you're not going to do this, then you're going to be punished and there is no man or God who will be able to deliver you from my hand. And that brings us to, I think, one of the most important statements in this story. Here we are, Daniel chapter 3. Verse 16. O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. Nebuchadnezzar said, there's no God that's going to be able to deliver you from my hand. That they said, our God can. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. To me, verse 18 is important because they say, we are confident that our God will deliver us. But even if he doesn't, which means even if this costs us our lives, we're still not going to do what God has said not to do. We're still not going to bow down to these idols. Daniel took a risk in chapter 1 by his request for a dietary exemption. He took somewhat of a risk in chapter 2 when he went before the king. These men take a risk, a direct risk to their lives, because Nebuchadnezzar has to do this or die. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, in the throngs of people around, they're thinking, what's the big deal? Why would anybody risk their lives over this? But Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego do. They say, our God will deliver us, but even if he doesn't, we're still going to, you know, we're going to do what's right. We're not going to do this. Well, we know how the story turns out. They're thrown into the furnace of fire. You know, Nebuchadnezzar has it heated up, you know, so much the guys that are throwing them in get burned. Great story. And they, you know, look in, they say, I see. We put three men in there, right? I see four. And the fourth one's appearance is like a son of God. And you know, Nebuchadnezzar, just notice that when Nebuchadnezzar calls out, they are still in the fire. And he calls out to them, and what does he call them? Verse 26. He calls them servants of the Most High God. He's already been affected by this. And of course, when they are brought out free from harm, they don't even smell like they've been near a fire. Their clothes aren't burned, none of that. He blesses their God. He decrees that nobody should speak any offense against the God of Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. He rewards them. Okay, we studied three classic stories from the book of Daniel. Can we see in any of these situations that we might... Jeff's already talked about a little bit with Daniel in chapter 1. We might be in a position where in order to advance with the company, in order to advance in certain social circles, I may be expected to do things that I cannot do. That I cannot do as a Christian. What about this one, Daniel chapter 3? The same kind of thing, just more intense. What do you see here? What do you see here that has anything to say to situations I might encounter? David.
Some of the things that we deal with every day, we think, you know, if we do the right thing all the time, it's always going to go well with us. Well, it doesn't always go well.
And that's a good point, because that's when it gets really tough, is when I know I am doing what God says for me to do, but it, you know, right now everything, it feels rotten. It feels like I'm being punished for doing what's right. Daniel was willing to risk that. His three friends were willing to risk that, because that wasn't what mattered. It was God's favor that mattered ultimately. Barry? Anybody in here ever worked in customer service? Okay. You ever been asked to lie? The shipment went out yesterday. We never received the invoice. We never received all that kind of stuff. Okay. And it, you know, have your boss standing there. You tell them this, even though you know that's not true. So that's a real simplistic example, but it happens to people. Okay, do I tell the truth and face the consequences, or do I say, well, you know, Lord, my job's on the line, so I know you'll understand if I just, you know, kind of fib a little bit here. Just like Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, hey, look, we're government officials. We're trying to set, we don't really believe in this God. It's okay if we just, you know, just give a nod. It's kind of, everybody else is bowing down. All right, somebody else? Here, it's June. Wear this rainbow pin, this, but we're all doing this. I got nothing against rainbows. Okay? We all understand that's not that's not the issue. It's the symbolism that associates us with things that we cannot condone as Christians. What am I going to do? That's real. That's happening to people. All right. Real quickly, don't have much time to talk about Demas in the New Testament. Demas is what, and we talked about this a little bit before. We talked about John Mark and some other disciples. Demas is listed a couple of times as one of Paul's fellow workers, and when he's in prison the first time in Rome, when he's in house arrest, and writes Ephesians and Philippians, guess who's there with him? Well, Mark's there with him, and Luke's there with him, and Demas is there with him. And from all indications, Demas is, you know, he's sharing in the work of trying to spread the gospel. He's there with Paul. He's not, evidently not ashamed to assist Paul during his confinement in Rome the first time around. But then in 2 Timothy chapter 4, when Paul is in prison again, from all indications, the second time he's really in prison this time, and he writes to Timothy and he says, what about Demas? All right. He says he deserted me. And what does he say about it specifically? He deserted me because he loved this present world. Now others had left. He says, you know, Titus has gone to was it Dalmatia, Crescens to Galatia, or do I have that backwards? They've gone too, but there's no indication that they went. The reason they went seems to have been legitimate. Paul still feels empty because Luke is the only one who's still with him. But Demas hurts because he says, Demas forsook me having loved this present world. Remember, we talked about John Mark, leaving on that one occasion and turning back to go home and all the ramifications of that. And Demas is just a counterexample to, here's Daniel faced with a choice that could have very ugly consequences for him, but it's the choice to do what God says. Here's Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego faced with, you know, bow down before the image or die. And they choose to face the prospect of death rather than betray God through idolatry. Here's Demas. I don't know exactly what pressures were brought to bear on him. You know, what is it exactly that caused him to abandon Paul there in Rome? Paul's, you know, he has loved this present world or this present age is pretty general. It may be that it was a whole lot less of a threat than the death threats that Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego got and the potential bad things that Daniel was facing. And as far as Satan is concerned, it's, you know, it doesn't matter. The pressure is, am I going to choose what's right or am I going to choose what's easy? I'm going to choose to go along. Well, we'll look at lesson number 23. We're getting pretty close. We've just got one more week in this series. Lesson 23 on Sunday, continuing our study of Young Faces of Faith. Hope you'll join us then.